Hey there, and welcome to Cyberpunk Librarian, Episode 16, Cypherpunk Librarian. I'm Daniel Messer. Hello there, and welcome back to another episode of Cyberpunk Librarian. My name is Daniel Messer, your friendly neighborhood cyberpunk librarian, and hey, welcome to episode 16, what I think is going to be a fairly important episode of the show, but you know, hey, we've made it to 16 episodes, I think that's kind of important too. Still running, still got ideas, still got things to talk about, and hey, it is nice to have you listening in on your podcatcher of choice, not hitting stop, not hitting delete, not rage quitting the entire thing and throwing your mobile phone or iPad or whatever it is you use to listen to podcasts against the wall and swearing. So, hey, thank you for keeping your cool and thank you for tuning in. It is a beautiful sunny day here in Arizona as per the usual, but we have hit the monsoon seasons and wow. Yeah, I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of a monsoon in Arizona, but we're talking about 3,000 foot high walls of dust moving into the Queen Creek, Phoenix, and Valley of the Sun area, blotting out the sun, looking like apocalyptic end times. Yeah, it's a scene out of a movie. It's kind of cool in some ways because, you know, it's just dust. I mean, it makes things dirty. But for a while, you know, it looks kind of interesting. It's kind of cool. Sometimes after the dust comes the rain. And if you thought the dust made things dirty, well, the rain turns all the dirt into mud and it makes it even worse. But we need the rain. And if we have to take the dust to get the rain, that's okay with me. So, what are we going to do on this episode of Cyberpunk Librarian? Well, if you caught the little intro there that I always do before the show, you'll know that the title of this is Cypherpunk Librarian. Well, we're going to be talking about how to keep yourself protected and private online. And we'll go into this in more detail a little later, of course. But before we get started, I want to sort of drop a disclaimer in here. And this may sound like sort of tinfoil hat Dan's the conspiracy theorist. He looks up to the question as his favorite superhero. But the fact is, some of the things I'm going to tell you about, it looks like if you read the recent news articles and check out anything that's sort of outside American newspapers and American media, it looks like that sometimes merely searching for information on some of this stuff will put you on some kind of watch list somewhere by some three-letter alphabet agency working for the United States government. Now, I just want you to know that, but you can probably take some comfort in the fact that chances are if you're listening to this and you're a librarian, you're probably on some kind of watch list anyway because librarians are into the whole freedom of information thing. And most governments, the United States government included, aren't into the freedom of information thing. But with information freedom also comes a bit of information privacy, because while information wants to be free, you still have a fundamental right to privacy, and that means you have a right to privacy, or privacy if you come from across the pond. You have a fundamental right to privacy online, too. I mean, no one should be able to tap your phone conversations without some kind of search warrant. And the thing, same thing kind of goes for the internet. No one should be able to track your internet habits without some kind of search warrant. So we're going to talk today about several ways to keep yourself safe and secure and maintain some form of privacy online. Now, we're going to keep it simple. We're going to make it so that just by listening to this and getting a few ideas, you can get set up fairly quickly. We're not going to go into the advanced mathematics of cryptography. We're not going to go into exactly how cryptography works and how these methods of privacy work. I'm just going to tell you that they do work, kind of give you a little overview, and we'll kind of just go from there. I don't want to overwhelm you with all of these technical jargonistic things, which are quite interesting, but only if you're interested in them. I mean, everybody kind of drives a car or has some experience with a car, but not everybody likes to open up the hood and get underneath and start tinkering. Yeah, it's not everybody's cup of tea. It's certainly not mine. I'm a really good driver, but you do not want me fixing your car. So, as things go, I happen to be a really decent geek, and I can fix your computer, and maybe I can keep you safe online too. Let's get started. When it comes to keeping yourself safe and secure in your digital and online life, it's sort of been found that people don't get into it as much as they probably should because there are some extra steps that you have to do. And maybe it's because we as an electronic and digitally based society have gotten spoiled because we didn't have to do these extra steps until fairly recently. And even now, we don't even have to do them, but you probably should. But we didn't have to do this before, and now we do. But if you think about it, where do you live your life for the most part? You probably live in some kind of house or apartment or something like that. Now, all your stuff, or at least most of your stuff probably, is at your apartment or house or wherever it is you live. Now, when you leave that place, do you just leave the doors unlocked and the windows open? Probably not, because you want to keep your stuff safe. You've probably got personal belongings in there. By that, I mean very personal belongings, like bank records and tax information and, you know, perhaps the deed to your house or whatever it is. You've got things in there that you don't just want anybody coming in and walking away with. So what do you do when you leave your house? Well, you lock it, right? And you feel pretty secure. The fact of the matter is, though, you're only putting one layer of security on top of your personal life that lives inside that house with you. Because as good as we feel about locking the door and going someplace knowing that our house is locked, we seem to forget that if someone really wants to get in, they can get in. You have windows. Windows break fairly easily. There's other ways to get into a house besides just going to the front door. So maybe you add an extra layer of security on top of that and you get, say, a dog. You get a fairly good-sized dog that, you know, he's not vicious, but when he barks, he sounds vicious. And there's an extra layer of security. Now you have a sentient being wandering around, sort of patrolling your stuff and keeping your place safe. But it's a dog. There's ways around the dog. So the dog starts barking when someone breaks the windows, and they can either feed a mistake or shoot him in the head or something like that. And, well, now they've eliminated both layers of your security. So you add an extra layer of security. And not only did you get a dog, now you've got a home alarm system. So if someone breaks the windows, well, now an alarm goes off. And the dog is barking. So you now have an audible alarm, a rather pissed off canine, and the person breaking in now has to start wondering, is this really worth my time and effort and the risk of getting caught? So my metaphor here is simply to say that we already layer bits of security onto our daily lives, things that we already do. You lock your house. You tell people where you're going. You might have good relationships with your neighbors. They know when you're home and when you're not. So when you're not home and there's a strange car in the driveway and someone wandering around your house, they know that's suspicious. Your dog is barking up a storm. Your alarm is going off. They know something's suspicious. We already layer security on top of our daily lives. And yet we've not really done that so much with our digital and online existence. Because we haven't had to until, well, WikiLeaks, Edward Snowden, other whistleblowers. I mean, the funny thing about the Snowden revelations and the Snowden papers and WikiLeaks is that for people like me who have been into the online world for some time, it really wasn't a surprise. It was not a shock. It kind of just confirmed things that we already suspected and took to be true. We knew that the government could watch everything we were doing online. We just didn't have proof of it. We knew that the three-letter alphabet agencies, the NSA, the CIA, the FBI, had technology, or at least had the capability of possessing technology, that could do everything that the Snowden revelations brought to light. This was not a shock for many of us. It was just confirmation of things that we already suspected. And, you know, between PRISM and X-Key Score, these things folded into something that we knew about long ago called Carnivore and Magic Lantern. And I'll put some links in the show notes. As a matter of fact, let me make a little note right here on my show notes to put those in the show notes, or I will forget. Because that's some important stuff that you should know about just so you know what's out there. Now, is the government watching you specifically? Probably not. Is anybody watching you specifically? Probably not. But as things go on, we find that governments, not just the United States government, you can bet if the U.S. government is doing it, so are other governments. But you can bet that someone out there somewhere is just scooping up a whole bunch of data, and then they'll go through it like a gold prospector with his sieve, just shaking things out, adding water, shaking things out, trying to find the stuff that they're really interested in. Now, like I said, that's not conspiracy theory nonsense. That's news. I will put links in the show notes to several articles from several sources. If you don't believe me, maybe you'll believe the mountain of evidence. But the fact is, even without this stuff going on, let's just say we lived in a perfect society where this wasn't happening, you probably should still keep your private life private online, or at least, you know, bits of it. You don't have to do all of your online world in a private manner, because you don't do all of your real life world in a private manner, too. You go outside, you walk down the street, you go to the mall, you get something to eat, you do things. You do things in public, and there's nothing wrong with doing things in public, online or off. But sometimes you should have a few layers of security, and that's what we're going to talk about starting right now. And like I said, I'm going to keep this very simple. We're not going to get into the whole cryptography thing, how this stuff works, why it works, how it changes, why mathematical algorithms that are a mile long keep you safe, the different kinds of ciphers from RSA to Blowfish and weird jargonistic stuff like that. We're not going to talk about that. What we're going to talk about is the things you can use that are much like a house key. You know how to use a house key to open and lock your house. You know how to use a car key or one of those little electronic fob things that remotely opens your car or locks it or sets off a panic button. You know how to use those. They're simple. And the reason they're simple is so everybody will use it. For the most part, your insurance companies want you to lock your car when you leave it. It keeps it safer, and that'll make for lower insurance premiums. Your house insurance and just yourself would really like it if you locked your house when you left it. That's sort of why there are locks on your house. And always keep in mind that if someone really wants to get at something, they probably can. This is just a sad fact of life. If I really want to break into your house, I can get into your house. It may not be subtle. It may not be, you know, sort of cat burglar type Cary Grant to catch a thief type getting into your house. But if someone really wants to get into your house, they can. So once you accept that, you can at least move on to keeping yourself as safe and secure as possible. So we are going to get into the heart of that right now with the different layers of security you can utilize at your choice. You don't have to do any of this, but I really recommend that you do at least a few things here. But we'll talk about the layers of security and how you can overlay them to make yourself a more secure, private, and safe online citizen. Thank you. When it comes to declaring your digital independence and stating that these things are mine and you cannot have them, the first thing to do that's very simple that anybody can do, yet a surprising number of people don't, is to simply secure your device. Using a PIN or a password on your phone, your tablet, all of your computers, these things are the first step to declaring your digital independence. If for no other reason, it's the first step to declaring that this house is mine and you may not have what's inside. And you do that by locking your door when you leave, right? Well, the same thing goes with your devices, and the same thing goes with your cell phone, your tablets, your computers, whatever. Nothing you have that accesses the online world should be without a PIN or a password. And we'll talk more about PINs and passwords in a bit. But if you have a device, if you're listening to this on your cell phone, or you're listening to this on your tablet, or whatever, and that thing that you're listening to this on does not have a password or a PIN set up on it, go ahead and pause this podcast and go put one on it. I'll be here when you get back. It's okay. I will wait for you. Hold on. Okay, are you back? Great. Now then, the reason you want to do that is because if someone gets your phone and it doesn't have a PIN on it or a password, they basically have access to everything. Because your phone is just a computer. It has your browsing history on it. It has your contacts on it. It has everything you've pretty much ever done with your phone on it. Do you really want to just hand your phone to a stranger? Probably not. So why should you make it easy for someone to get into your devices if they steal them? And the answer is you shouldn't. You should make sure that everything you have that accesses the online world is locked down with a PIN or a password. Now, passwords are better than PINs, but I do admit that they take longer to enter, and that may or may not be a problem depending on what you have. If you're using a cell phone, it might be, you know, a smartphone, it might be a little bit of a thing to tap in a password all the time, so use a PIN. However, one thing that some folks don't realize is if you want something more secure than a four-digit PIN, but you don't want to tap in a long password, start adding numbers. You can set up a password on almost every device, from Androids to iOS devices to Windows devices, where the password is just a PIN. It's just a longer PIN. iOS devices, for instance, they only require a four-digit PIN, and it has to be a four-digit PIN. It cannot be three. The number of the PIN cannot be five. So if you want a longer PIN, just set it up for a password that happens to be nothing but numeric data. So if you want your PIN to be 12345, but your device only accepts 1234, set it up for a password, and now you can have as long a series of numbers as you like. Whatever you do, do something. Because if someone were to get a hold of your phone or your tablet or your computer, they basically now have their hands deep inside your digital life. They can start getting a hold of things that they can use to impersonate you online. They might have access to your passwords. They might have access to your banking data. Why would you not lock that up? Yet a surprising number of people don't. And I admit, it is a little bit of a thing that you have to enter a PIN every time you want to use your phone. But keep in mind that you're entering a PIN that only you know. And that should give you some peace of mind that if for some reason you lose your phone, you leave it at the coffee shop, it falls out of your bag, God forbid someone mugs you and steals your phone, at least it's going to give them a challenge. Chances are the phone will just be wiped and they'll start there rather than try and figure out a PIN. So that's your first step. All of your computers should have a password lock on them. And anymore, it's getting to the point that you have to actually work to not do a password lock on your computers. Windows, Linux, OS X, all of them will basically be set up by default to ask for a password when you log in. Keep that. Always keep that. You want your computer to ask you for a password. You want your computer to verify that it is you when you use it, for the same reason you want your front door to verify that it is you when you open it. And the way your front door verifies you is through your house key. And the way your computer verifies that it is you is through your password. Lock down your devices. Next, we're going to talk about securing your connection. Now, unfortunately, this one might cost you a little money because the methods that you use to secure a connection just simply aren't free. And even if they are free, you probably don't want to use it. You want to get a service that is reliable, that is concerned with your privacy, and a service that is looking out for you by not holding on to records or anything like that. Now, I will put some links in the show notes at cyberpunklibrarian.com/podcast. And you'll find a ton of links in those show notes this week, my friends. But the first three you're probably going to see is for a thing called a virtual private network or a VPN. Now, VPNs, like I said, the good ones aren't free. You're going to have to invest a little money. The good news is it's not very much money. I have three VPNs here that I can recommend and suggest. Check them out. Check out other VPNs. Your librarians, your digital citizens, you probably know how to do a little online research. But check these out. See which one works for you. The first one I'm going to talk about is private internet access, sometimes referred to as PIA. And like all VPNs, the way private internet access works is by setting up a connection from your computer to the internet that is encrypted. Everything coming in and going out is encrypted. And let me put it to you this way. I do not surf the internet on a public Wi-Fi system without a VPN. It's just too risky. I mean, yes, you could probably walk through a busy Starbucks wearing absolutely no clothing at all. And yes, there is a chance that people will not notice. But there's a pretty decent chance that people will notice. And that's kind of how I see an unencrypted internet connection on a coffee shop Wi-Fi. There's probably not a hacker sitting there waiting for someone to come in and start doing banking things or start doing personal private things at a Starbucks. But there could be. And the way that you get around this is simply by having a VPN, because this encrypts everything coming to and going off of your computer. It basically creates a tunnel through any internet connection that is yours and yours alone. So while everybody is traveling the super, you know, the information superhighway above you, your VPN is like a tunnel underneath that only you know about. So they're doing their things up there, and you're doing your things underneath it, just sailing along, and it's only you. So I use private internet access, which is a really good service, and it works everywhere. Private internet access, which is why I love this, works on OS X, works on Linux, works on Windows, works on Android, works on iOS. It pretty much works on everything. And it is very easy to set up. It is also very affordable. A year's worth of PIA is $39.95. Or you can do a monthly deal for $6.95. Now, I want to make sure that you all know this is not a paid advertisement. I am literally talking about the thing that I use every single day on almost all of my devices. So this is not paid endorsement. This is me telling you what I use. And I absolutely love private internet access. Works really well. It's very simple to set up, and it works everywhere. So if you're a cross-platform slider like me and into the whole use whatever operating system that you need at the time, private internet access is your friend. It's simple and it's easy. It's also fairly affordable. I mean, $40 for a year, that's not bad. That's not bad at all. There are others. There's ProXPN. There's TorGuard. And like I said, I'll have these in the show notes. And I've heard good things about these from people that I trust, but I've never used them myself. So look into them. See if there's one that you like better. Look at the features and decide for yourself. But for goodness sake, I really do recommend you spending the money. Because a VPN not only protects your IP, but your location. A VPN makes it appear that you're somewhere else because the way is it basically encrypts your traffic coming out of your computer, right? But instead of it going directly to a server from whatever internet connection you're using, it first routes it through another server someplace else. And that makes it look like you are wherever that place is. So most of the time when I connect to my VPN, it looks like I'm in California or Seattle, perhaps Texas. I can also tell it I would like to look like I'm in the Netherlands or in Europe or London or Toronto. Because with private internet access, you can tell it which one you want to connect to. And that will make it appear that you're in a different place. So not only does the VPN protect your connection, it protects your location, which is kind of cool. And because you can appear to be somewhere else, this is a little side benefit, you may be able to access things that are blocked because of location. So if you're kind of into the BBC iPlayer and watching things on the BBC website, you can use a VPN to make it look like you're in the UK. It's kind of underhanded. It's kind of mean. It might be slightly illegal, I'm not sure. But you can do that because you look like you're somewhere else. Also, downloading. Legal or illegal, maybe you just don't want someone looking in your shopping cart. Have you ever been to a store when there's a big sale going on and you're actually watching people like filching stuff out of other people's shopping carts? Well, yeah, that's rude and it's kind of mean-spirited and you kind of want to give them a backhand. So even if you're just doing legal downloading, which is perfectly legitimate stuff, like you're downloading a Linux distribution through a torrent, which is really the only way to get a Linux distribution in a reasonable amount of time. Yeah, that's legal, but you don't need the world knowing about it. That's not their business. So it protects you there too. And like I said, with a public network, it eliminates the man-in-the-middle attacks. So yeah, if someone tries to get in on your connection, they're just going to see a bunch of encrypted communication that they should not be able to break into. So the one thing you do have to remember is that a VPN will encrypt everything, but what comes out on the other side may not be. So if you're connecting to a website somewhere else and that website doesn't have any kind of encryption on it, then yeah, people can see what you're doing on that website. But they'd have to be looking at that website and they'd have to know what's your connection. In the end, it just goes back to the layers of security. If someone really wants to track you, they can. But you're going to make it harder with a VPN. Much harder. So invest a little bit of money. You don't have to use it all the time, but when you're doing your banking or anything private, use it. That's what it's for. And if you want to use it all the time, well, you're paying for it. Why not? So moving beyond the VPN, like I said, we're keeping things simple. All of this stuff is easy to do and doesn't require a lot of setup or geekery or hacking about with your computer. And this next part is going to be about secure browsing. And this is stuff that you can do in almost any browser, at least any modern browser, and things that you can use to keep yourself safe and secure as you browse the internet on whatever browser you prefer to use. Because as a web guy, I know there are a few out there, and they all act a little differently. But for the most part, most modern browsers have something called an incognito or privacy mode. You should totally use that whenever you are accessing things that you don't want your computer to remember. Do you really not want your computer to remember the password for your bank or for your checking account or things like that? Then you should use incognito mode or privacy mode. It depends on what browser you're using as to what they call it. In incognito mode, nothing is saved. It doesn't retain your passwords. It doesn't remember cookies. It doesn't remember what you've done as far as what websites you access. So that stuff doesn't get added to your browser history. It just doesn't remember. That's the entire point. So if you want to do something where you just don't want someone to get into that information, you don't want it to show up in your browser history. And I know what some people are thinking, ha ha ha, that's how you would surf for porn. Well, yeah, it is how you would surf for porn. It's also how you would surf for a gift for your significant other and you share a computer and you don't want your significant other that you were looking at that really cool thing on Amazon.com. There's a double-edged sword here wherein, yes, you lock your house because you want to keep your stuff safe, but you also lock your house because you don't want people to walk in on you while you're in the bathroom. So, yeah. Incognito mode is for that. And anytime you want to surf a little bit more securely than just your average run-of-the-mill daily browsing around the internet, use incognito mode. Check with your browser's website to see exactly how you activate that. In most browsers, it's usually something like Control or Command if you're on a Mac, but it's usually like Control Shift P for privacy. So look around. It's there, I guarantee you, unless you're using something very weird and wild. Then you might want to switch to another browser that does nothing but incognito mode. And that's another thing you can do. I know of a few people who have Opera on their device, whatever it is, like a laptop or a desktop computer. And they use Opera for nothing but incognito mode. That's fine. That's something you can do. Exercise your options. Beyond that, if you're going to be into secure browsing, I really recommend you use Firefox over Chrome. And this is sort of another tinfoil hat thing, but the fact is that Firefox is not recording everything you're doing and sending it back to Google for analyzing and looking at the things you are interested in. Now, I don't really have a problem with Google doing that with their browser, as long as people are educated about that. And for the most part, Google is fairly upfront with the fact that that's what Chrome is doing. That Chrome does analyze what you're looking at and kind of figures out how to deal ads and things like that. So, okay, as long as you know that that's happening, fine. But if you do not want to be tracked in such a way, you really should use Firefox, because the Mozilla Foundation cares about an open and secure internet and an open and secure web. So they're not tracking you. However, other people might be. And that's where we get into the wonderful world of browser plugins, and I will have these linked in the show notes at cyberpunklibrarian.com/podcast. There are two browser plugins that I cannot recommend highly enough. One is AdBlock Plus. It works, I believe, everywhere. I believe it even works in Internet Explorer. I know it works on Chrome and Firefox. It is usually the first plugin I install with a new installation of Firefox or Chrome. AdBlock Plus pretty much does exactly what it sounds like. It blocks ads. Now, there is a sort of debate that goes on. Well, if you're blocking ads, then the websites you're visiting aren't getting any ad revenue, and you're basically taking money out of their pocket because they have to pay for that, and the way they pay for it is through ads. Well, yes and no. Yes and no. I kind of see using a website the way I see walking down the street. I'm accessing something sort of passively. I want to look at Reddit. I want to look at YouTube. So I do. When I'm walking down the street, I want to look at this window over here, because there's something cool behind the window. It's a shop window, and they've got something cool behind it. I want to look at it there. That's a sort of a passive thing. Now, I expect when I look in the shop window, there to be a little ad there to tell me what I'm looking at and how much it costs. And that's fine. I don't mind that. And if it's a shop I like, I might even support that shop by going in and buying the thing that I thought was kind of cool. AdBlock Plus allows you to do much the same thing, where you can go to a site, and if you like that site and you want to support that site by making sure that at least you see their ads and they get the revenue from just showing you an ad, you can turn off AdBlock. That's what I do for Reddit and YouTube, because as much as I hate YouTube pre-roll ads, I know that the creators I like to watch and the YouTubers I like to watch get paid for those ads. So it's a small inconvenience to sit through 5 seconds of an ad that I can click skip this ad to watch CGP Grey, or to watch a Brady Heron video, or to watch Kurt J. Mack, or to watch any of the other YouTubers that I watch. I will support them by disabling AdBlock Plus. And I disable AdBlock Plus on Reddit and Wallbase and all kinds of sites where I don't mind supporting them. But you see, in that instance, I've exercised something that you did not have before AdBlock Plus, and I exercised choice. I want to support this site, so I am choosing to support this site. when I go to some news site that is throwing ads at me, it even throws up an ad before I can read the stupid article that I wanted to read. No, not only is that bad behavior on the part of a website, but I'm not going to support you in that way. I'm just not. I don't choose to. So I turn on Adblock Plus for that site. But you have choice, and it blocks the ads that you normally do not want to see. And that keeps other agencies from tracking you online, because if they don't give you the ad, you don't get the tracking cookie, which is good. Another one is called Privacy Badger, and this is from the Electronic Frontier Foundation themselves. Privacy Badger does sort of what like Adblock Plus does, but it does it with all kinds of cookies and tracking aids and options and stuff like that. And like I said, I'll have these linked in the show notes at cyberpunklibrarian.com/podcast. There'll be links there. You can get more information on it just by simply clicking the link, because they describe their products so much better than I do. But the thing about Privacy Badger and Adblock Plus is they prevent other companies from tracking you online, because unfortunately, when you leave a site, that doesn't necessarily mean that someone's not following you. To put it in a real life scenario, say I went into that store that I was just talking about, that had the cool thing in the window. I'm like, hey, I like that cool thing in the window. Can I buy it? And they say, of course you can. And they sell it to me and I give them my money and I put it in my bag and I walk out of the store. And I'm walking down the sidewalk and I'm thinking, cool, I got a new thing. I can't wait to get home and try my new thing. And then I notice, hey, there's a guy following me. I remember seeing that guy at the store. That's weird. Ah, maybe he's just going the same way I'm going. So I go into a coffee shop. The guy comes into the coffee shop and he sits down behind me and he notes down the coffee that I'm drinking. And he, you know, mutters a little something to himself, maybe makes a quick text message. And as I leave the coffee shop, he follows me out of the coffee shop down the street to, say, a fast food place where I pick up a hamburger. He notes the hamburger that I've eaten, where I bought it from, how much it cost me. You see, that's exactly what tracking cookies are like. Facebook is notorious for this, and they got caught with it a while back, where they were tracking what you were doing after you left Facebook. Facebook? Facebook. Let's not add an extra T in there. They were tracking what you're doing after they left the site. Is that something you want? Probably not. So exercise your right to choice. Get these plugins for your browser and turn them on and off on the sites that you wish to support and leave them off on the sites you do not wish to support. Okay, finally, if you want to really stay secure, there is a project out there called Tor Browser. Now, T-O-R is for the Onion Router. And I keep talking about layers of security. That's how the Onion Router kind of works. It basically bounces your traffic in an encrypted form all over the planet to not only protect where you are located, but what you are doing. If you're using a VPN and a Tor browser, it's going to be very difficult to track you. Not impossible, but it's going to be difficult. Now, Tor browser is absolutely free. I have a link in the show notes. You can get it at torproject.org. And it's based off of Firefox. Like I said, Mozilla considers the open and secure web to be a priority. So Tor browser itself is based on Firefox. If you know how to use Firefox, you know how to use the Tor browser. And the Tor browser comes with various tools that when you launch it, it will connect you to the Tor network. And at that point, you become a little bit more secure than you were to begin with. Now, Tor is one of those things that I talked about earlier that could put you on a watch list, because it looks like the governments of several countries are really interested in the people that know how to use Tor. They see that as a potential threat, because their idea is, and this is crazy talk, but the idea is, well, if you have nothing to hide, then you have nothing to fear. Well, I don't have anything to hide, folks, but I still close the door behind me when I'm in the shower. And I still, you know, go into a public restroom and make sure the door is shut behind me before I start doing my business. I'm not doing anything weird. Everybody takes a shower and everybody goes to the bathroom. But that doesn't mean I need people watching me do it. That's how I respond to, if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear. I don't have anything to hide. That doesn't mean I want someone looking in my window 24/7. And Tor browser will help you maintain more security online. And you can find out more about that at the Tor project. Like I said, I don't want to get into the whole basis of how these things work, because the show's going to be long enough. You don't need to hear me drone on and on about encrypted traffic bouncing between places on the globe and all of that stuff, and how there are undernet Tor sites that you can only access through Tor because they have these weird, complicated looking URLs. Just go look it up if you have the interest. It's easy to use. If you just want to use it, you can use it. I guarantee. If you're able to get podcasts and have the wherewithal to be able to get podcasts delivered to you via your device, you can use Tor browser. It's simple. Now, speaking of devices, let's move on to mobile use. And it's amazing how much of our life is lived around our mobile devices. I love my MacBook Air, and I pretty much take it everywhere I go. But not quite everywhere. For the most part, I'll take my iPad, or I'll take my phone. Most certainly my phone. When I leave the house without my phone, I feel like I've left the house without my pants. So, yeah, my phone is a massive part of my online existence. So I want to keep that secure as well. And I talked about locking it down with a password, and my phone is locked down with a PIN. It's not an average PIN. It's not four digits. I'm not going to tell you how many digits it is. It is not four. It is more than that. Usually, the more digits, characters, whatever you have, the more secure your device. But I also use some apps on that phone, and I can recommend some apps for your device that will sort of make things a little more secure as you go along in your mobile life. The first one is an app called Text Secure. And Text Secure is a text messaging and multimedia messaging app for Android. They do not have an iOS version yet, but I'm told they're working on it. You can get this from whispersystems.org, and of course I'll have this linked in the show notes. Text Secure is basically encrypted text messaging and multimedia messaging, so encrypted SMS and MMS. On my Android device, where I use a Samsung Galaxy Note 3, I've set it as my default text app. So sometimes I get a text from people who work at the library, and that might have stuff in it that I don't want people to just be able to pick up my phone and see. It might have a password. It might have the name of a server. I don't need everybody knowing those things. So yes, I have to put in a password to see my texts. Yes, this is one more thing I have to do. But it's a quick password. I know the password very well. It takes me about 2 seconds to type it in, and then I'm good. So it's really not that big a deal. And my texts are more secure. Maybe my wife sends me a text. I don't want everybody seeing what my wife says. So, yeah, it just keeps things a little more secure. Another app called Chat Secure does kind of the same thing, but it's with chat. So it's more of a real-time back-and-forth sort of Google Talks kind of thing. It works with XMPP, which is what Google Talk uses. So, yeah, this is a lockdown secure chat system that, you know, is available for Android and iOS. That one's out there for both. So if you do a lot of online chat using your device or your iPad or your Android tablet, might be something to look into. And like I said, we'll have links in the show notes to that. Speaking of chat, if you're on the iOS side of things, I do have an app for you that is iOS only, and it's called CryptoCat. And this is group chat. So even though you can kind of do group chat with Chat Secure and Google and XMPP, CryptoCat is actually sort of set up to do that in and of itself. So once again, it's secure, it's locked down. So yeah. And finally, for chat programs, there's one available for iOS and Android called Wickr. I hate it when they do this. This is so Web 2.0, but it's not W-I-C-K-E-R. No, it is W-I-C-K-R. It's like Flickr, but with a W. Yeah. I don't know why leaving out the E is such a big deal, but they left out the E. And we have Wickr, which is secure chat with an optional time bomb to delete a message after a given time. So in some ways, it's like, it's kind of like the, goodness, I just lost the name of the app, but it's the picture app that will delete the picture after Snapchat. There it is. I knew it would come to me. More coffee, please. It's kind of like Snapchat in how the message will self-destruct after a certain amount of time. Wickr does this too. It will delete itself after a certain amount of time, whether you've seen it or not. So, good stuff there. Now then, for your device, there is also Tor browsers for pretty much everything, because the Tor project likes to make sure that their devices work, or their devices, their software will work on other platforms too, and they have different offshoots that are working with them on that front. So if you're using an Android device, there is an app called Connector. And this is spelled kind of weird, and I will have a link in the show notes so you can find it easier. But it's C-O-N-N-E-C, the plus sign, then plus sign O-R. So instead of T's, they have plus signs. Okay, whatever. Anyway, this is Tor browser for Android. And if you are rocking the iOS ecosphere, you can use Red Onion, which is not free. I want to say it's like $1.99. But for $1.99, you get a fully functional Tor browser for iOS. And I've used Red Onion. I've used Connector. I think they're both very well done. I've used all of the stuff that I'm recommending to you here in this mobile section. I've used Chat Secure. I use Text Secure every day. I've used CryptoCat a bit. It's not something that I use often. I liked Wickr, but you kind of have to have other people using Wickr to make it work. So unless your friends or your contacts are using Wickr, it's not as valuable as you might think. But if you do have friends and family using it, it's great. It'll be great for you. And then Connector and Red Onion, I use both of those, whatever device I'm holding at the time. If I need sort of my, you know, security, and I want to browse securely or chat securely, those are things available to me. And going back one more time, because I just can't get off this metaphor apparently, the layers of security. If I want to maintain a really decent secure presence, I will not only use Text Secure or Chat Secure on my device, I will have the device locked down with a VPN too, because private internet access allows you to have a VPN on your iPad or on your Android or whatever. So, yet another layer of security. So, communications in real time or through text, those are sort of like the standards of our day. But there is still a lot to be said about email. Now, email is a little bit more complicated, and the reason it's more complicated is because you can send encrypted messages all day long. But unless the other person on the other side is also using an encryption program, and chances are using the same encryption program, they're probably not going to be able to read it. They're probably not going to send you encrypted messages. So, this is where you get into the problem with email. Pretty much with secure email, both parties involved in the communications have to come to an agreement that we are going to use secure email, and this is what we are going to use. Now, a really easy secure email system is called Hushmail, and you can find this at hushmail.com. I use Hushmail, and it's exactly what it sounds like. It's just secure email. You have to realize, though, that what's coming into Hushmail and what you get out of Hushmail is secure, but what you send out of Hushmail is not, unless someone else is also using Hushmail too. Now, Hushmail is accessed through a website. You just go to hushmail.com and log in. But if I take my Hushmail account and write an email to my friend who's on Gmail, they're going to get my email. Sure, absolutely. But their response back to me may not be encrypted. It may just go ahead and quote my entire email stock. And then that sent message is in their sent box on Gmail. So secure email is a bit of a thing. And that's why it's one of those things you'll find people working hard on, because they want to get this easier to use. There are other options for secure email. But once again, you kind of have to agree to use them amongst your friends and contacts. One of which is BitMessage. BitMessage is a very interesting thing that I've used a bit, that uses BitTorrent and encryption to basically lock down your communications. And I'll put a link in the show notes, because that's something you really need to go look at yourself and decide if it's something you want to use. I've used it a bit. I think it's kind of cool. But once again, to send a bit message to someone, you have to send it to their bit message address. And, well, you know, if they're not using bit message, then they're not going to get that message. And then finally, sort of the all-encompassing GPG, which is for GNU Privacy Guard. It's basically an open source version of PGP, which was short for Pretty Good Privacy. GPG is public key encryption, which means there are two keys to access your messages in your email. And GPG will work with several different email clients. It doesn't really work very well online, though. So if you use Gmail and just access Gmail through the web browser, GPG is not really going to be your thing, because GPG likes to work with a client of some kind like Thunderbird or Mail.app or something like that. There is a GPG for Outlook too. I've used that myself. But public key encryption is kind of like the it's kind of like the movies where you see them launching a missile or something, and you need two keys to launch the missile. Well, public key encryption is like that, where you have a key that is public, and you can share that key with anyone. You can paint it on the side of a building. It's usually a bunch of letters, and it says that it's a GPG private or public key. And what that does is it gives people the ability to send you messages encrypted for you and to you. However, to decrypt the message, you need a private key, which is a key that you share with nobody. And this is like when they're launching the missile. One guy has to plug his key into the slot. Another guy plugs his key into the slot. They count to three and turn the keys at the same time. That's kind of how GPG works. You get your message. It's encrypted using your public key. And now you use your private key to decrypt it. So it's an interesting way to do it. I like GPG. Unfortunately, not too many of my friends use GPG. So I wind up sending a lot of unencrypted email just like everybody else. We'll have links in the show notes, cyberpunklibrarian.com/podcast. Check those out. You can get more information there. All right, coming up to the end. I promise we're almost done with all the tech talk, but I've got a couple more things that you might be interested in. And this is the ability to leave no trace. If you really need to do something where you do not want to leave any trace of your existence on a computer, you have options. And one of those options is Tails. And Tails is short for the Amnesiac Incognito Live System. It is a Linux distribution that you can put on a flash drive, because that's exactly how it's meant to be used. And you can plug it into a computer, boot off the flash drive. It will boot into a Linux environment that is encrypted. It encrypts your user space, and it has several different tools, including the Tor browser, to maintain privacy in your communications online. So you can pick that up, and this is yet another thing that can get you on a watch list, unfortunately. And the reason why is because Glenn Greenwald with The Guardian and Edward Snowden himself use Tails because of its ability to remain incognito, to remain under the radar. It runs on a flash drive, and I actually wear mine around my neck. I have Tails with me pretty much wherever I go. I don't need it all that often, but sometimes I do need to get into a computer, and if nothing else, I just don't want to mess up anybody else's computer. I need to do this one thing. I don't want to, you know, I don't need to look at their stuff. They don't want me looking at their stuff, but I can boot through Tor, boot through Tails, and do my thing. When you log off and shut the computer off or reboot it and pull the flash drive, you've never touched the hard drive. You've never actually physically touched the computer, the computer's main storage systems, because you've done everything off the flash drive. So it doesn't even know you were there. Or, if you don't want to go quite that far, you can also carry a live distribution of Linux on a flash drive and maybe set it up without any persistent storage, or do whatever you want. Ubuntu, all of the Ubuntu varieties boot from a live stick. Almost all modern Linux distributions support some kind of live booting from a USB stick or whatever. Not only do I carry Tor around my neck, I carry Kubuntu around my neck. I can plug that into a computer, as long as it's not a Mac, and boot into Kubuntu. It's great. And on that one, I carry stuff that I don't mind people seeing. If I lose my Kubuntu stick, it's not really that big a deal. It's really not. I'm going to be more upset that I lost a perfectly good 16 gigabyte USB stick than I'm going to be that I lost my Kubuntu installation. So if you want to leave no trace, use a flash drive with a Linux distribution on it. They're easy to create, and I'll put a couple links in the show notes as to how to do it with a program called UnetBootin, which allows you to create a live USB stick in everything. It works in Linux, it works in Windows, it works on a Mac. So there's that one. Or if you already happen to have Ubuntu or you're using the Ubuntu system someplace, there's a way to create a live booting USB Ubuntu stick right in Ubuntu. And I'll have links to that in the show notes. So, finally, I'm almost done, I promise. And I hope that some of these ideas have kept you, you know, have at least spurred some ideas in your mind to keep you a little safer online. But I've saved sort of the best one for last. And it's also one of the easiest ones for last. Because all of this that I've talked about circles back to the one thing that we talked about first, and that's passwords. Everything you access from your computer to your email to your calendar to your bank to logging into YouTube to logging into your favorite forum where you talk about cooking, all of that requires passwords. And you need to use good passwords. Every so often we hear about a company that got hacked and user data was stolen, and there's almost always at least one or two articles that come out about, oh my God, look at the passwords that some of these people were using, and I bet they were using the same password in multiple places, and a lot of them are. So it may sound weird where it's like, I'm telling you, you should have a different password for everything. And people say, well, that's too much to remember. Well, yes, maybe it is, but there are things out there to help you. And one of these things is LastPass. LastPass has a browser plugin that works pretty much everywhere on everything because it's a browser plugin that allows you to set up a LastPass account for free, though they do have a premium account, which you should look into. So you set up your LastPass account and then you set it up with a good password, a very good password. I recommend at least 20 some odd characters in a password that you can remember. That's the password you need to remember. It is also, as the name implies, the last password you will need to remember. So make it a good one, because what LastPass does is locks down all of your passwords and then it populates the login forms for you. I use LastPass on pretty much everything that's computer. So my Mac has LastPass on it. The Windows laptop that I use at work has LastPass on it. My desktop computers have LastPass on them. Yeah, I have a good password to open up LastPass. But after that, I don't even know some of my passwords, and I don't need to know them. For the same reason, you probably cannot sit where you're sitting right now or walk where you're walking or doing whatever you're doing and tell me exactly what your house key looks like. You can't tell me how many notches it has cut in it. You can't tell me how many little peaks it has on it and how high they are. You don't know that, most likely. And that's okay, because it works. LastPass functions on sort of the same philosophy. You don't need to know your password. You just need to make sure it works. And as long as you remember your master password, then that's all you need. So, like for Facebook, my Facebook account got broken into a couple times about 3 or 4 years ago. And that's when I really started looking at solutions like LastPass, because I was using a fairly secure password. But, you know, sort of once they got it, they got it. And it was something like 8 characters. It was alphanumeric, but I didn't have any special characters in it or anything like that. Now my Facebook password is something like 20 characters. It is a bunch of gibberish and garbage. It has special characters, upper and lowercase letters, numbers, all of it. It's a very secure password that is pretty much impossible to guess. I mean, you would be better off banging your hands on the keyboard and hitting enter every so often than you would be trying to guess my password. But I don't know my Facebook password. I don't need to know it. I can get into Facebook using LastPass. The same goes with my Gmail password, my Twitter password. All of this is very locked down and very secure. Not because I don't know my passwords, mind you, but because I have one key that opens them all. LastPass is great. There's also another one called 1Password that does essentially the same thing. Look into both and see which one you like. We'll have links in the show notes. Now, if the idea of keeping your passwords in a sort of cloud solution where you, you know, are trusting it to a server someplace, and that kind of makes you sort of squirm a little bit, and believe me, it does me too. There is another system called KeePass. That's K-E-E capital P-A-S-S. KeePass is a standalone and works everywhere. It's totally cross-platform, and you can put it on that flash drive that you always have with you. You can carry it around with you. You can put it in a Dropbox. You can put it on a Google Drive. You can put it in a BitTorrent sync file, whatever, wherever you access it, it's there for you. And it does essentially the same kinds of things that LastPass and 1Password does without the browser plugin functionality. You launch KeePass, it's going to ask for a long password. It wants a good password too. And that unlocks a vault that keeps all of your other passwords in it. And the nifty thing is I use this for like FTP sites and things like that I don't always need to access, and I don't access through a browser anyway. So when I'm using FileZilla, I don't want FileZilla to save all of my passwords. I just don't. That sounds like a bad idea. So I launch KeePass, I put in a password, it gives me my list of passwords, and you can double click on the password for a site, and what it does is it copies it into the clipboard for 12 seconds. And in that 12 seconds, you can go paste it into a form or paste it into a box someplace and hit enter. After 12 seconds, it wipes the clipboard, so that password is no longer there in memory. So it keeps it safe and secure, but it also makes it easy to get to. So those are three options for getting yourself some secure passwords. And all three of them will generate a secure password for you based on things that you enter. So you can say, I want a 10-character password that has upper and lowercase letters and no special characters. And then hit generate and you get it. And then you can copy and paste that into whatever. Great. If you need to just make a password, you're sitting there at your computer, you're logging into a thing, it's quick time to change your password and you need to generate something, there's a couple places you can go online. One place is strongpasswordgenerator.com. It does exactly what it says it does. I'm also going to provide a link in the show notes to a decent Lifehacker article on 4 methods to create a secure password that you'll actually remember. So one thing I can tell you, just sort of like kick things off and at least make you think about this, is the idea that if you create a password that is a secure password, you can add things to it to make it easier to remember. So say you come up with a string of 8 characters and numbers that are easy for you to remember. The one that I kind of use as sort of an example is the letters O, I, C, U, the number 8, 1, 2. And that translates out to OICU 812. Now, if you want to at least have some security, this isn't going to make you incredibly secure, but it does make you more secure. You can add that to another password or another service or whatever, a name, to keep things a little more secure. So one thing I've told people that, you know, better than using password, better than using 1234 or your cat's name or something like that, pick a, you know, a alphanumerical combination like OICU 812, maybe something a little more secure than that, and then just add it to the name of the service. So maybe your Dropbox password is Dropbox OICU 812, or Gmail OICU 812, or YouTube. Well, YouTube is the Gmail login, but Reddit. So your password might be Reddit OICU 812. All you'd have to remember is the string of characters and the name of the service you're logging into. It's not a great method, but it is a better method than using the same password everywhere and using the same password for everything. Because the thing that we find out when we get these hack alerts where someone's system was hacked. Well, we find out that a lot of people use the same password in the same they use the same password for different services. So you'll find someone in there that's, you know, we've got their email address and we've got their password that they use to access whatever site got hacked this week. And okay, so george@gmail.com uses the password Washington to access this site. I wonder if george@gmail.com uses that to access his gmail.com too. And then they'll just go try. And that can be automated and it can be, you know, basically sped up to where a computer's trying the entire list and just making notes of what works. So use a different password everywhere. Make sure it's a strong password that is not easy to guess. It's advisable to stay away from names of loved ones, birth dates, things like that. It's actually better for you to just beat on the keyboard for a couple seconds and see what comes up. That would be a better password than any word you can pull out of the dictionary. And in the end, you can use a combination of these things to make them work for you and make them fit better into your life. You don't have to use all of these things. You don't have to use a VPN. You don't have to always use incognito mode. You don't have to suddenly switch to text secure on your phone. But I don't think it's going to be too big a deal if you make sure that all of your devices have a PIN or a password to access them. And I don't think it's going to be all that big a deal if you use LastPass. Just the combination of those two little changes, or using 1Password instead of LastPass if you like that more. Those two little changes will make you that much more secure in your online and in your digital life. And that brings to a close another episode of Cyberpunk Librarian. I do apologize for the length of the show. I know we ran long this time around, but I think it was an important topic to cover, and there was just so much to cover. But I hope it helped. I hope you picked up some ideas. I hope you picked up some tips and tricks for being a little more safe and secure online. And hey, you might even share this with patrons and stuff like that, because I'm sure you've got people that come in and use your library's open Wi-Fi network to access the internet and make things work that way. And I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but your open Wi-Fi access is just as safe and secure as anybody else's open Wi-Fi access. So, yeah, maybe pass the knowledge along, maybe have a crypto party, talk to people about this. Whatever works for you, just pass it along, because the more people that know how to be safe and secure online, the more safe and secure the online world actually is. The music you're listening to is Silver Fences by TARDIS. Oh my god, TARDIS is so amazing. It's spelled like the Doctor Who conveyance, but with an extra S, so that's T-A-R-D-I-S-S. So cool, good down-tempo music, and I picked that up from the Free Music Archive. Yes, freemusicarchive.org is where you can get some excellent tunes for any project that you might be doing. Give the artist a little proper credit like I'm doing here. For Silver Fences by TARDIS, good stuff, good down-tempo, but they've got everything in all kinds of genres. Check them out. And also dig on Slow Stitch, which was the song you heard earlier in the program, also by TARDIS. I will have links to the show in the show notes for both of these songs. As always, the opening track is Belly Dance at Ebisu by Ryo Miyashita. All of that came from the Free Music Archive. You should check it out. Good stuff there. If you want to message me or contact me, you certainly can do so through the normal, non-encrypted channels like cyberpunklibrarian@gmail.com. You can hit me up on Twitter. I am @Bibrarian. That's B-I-B-R-A-R-I-A-N. It's like librarian, but with a B. You can also hit me on Google Plus. I am google.com/plus Daniel Messer. Look forward to hearing from you. Or you can also drop a link in the show notes at cyberpunklibrarian.com/podcast. We would love to hear from you. If you have some other ideas for keeping yourself safe and secure online. I'd love to hear them. I can always add them to the show notes. I give proper credit where credit's due because before I was a librarian, I was a historian. I try real hard to cite my sources. But for now, I thank you for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed the show. I will see you again in 2 weeks for another episode of Cyberpunk Librarian. But for now, I'm going to go ahead and sign off. My name is Daniel Messer, and I just want to remind you that you don't have to be high-tech to be low-budget, but it certainly helps if you're a cyberpunk. Take care now.